You're listening to Arrivé by the Cycling Podcast.
Buonasera, Lionel.
Hello, boring, Daniel.
Boring Pogacar.
Yeah, dull, wasn't it?
Enjoy that, Lionel.
Oh, I mean, that was one slog. Of the best races. I mean, it was a slog for 5.5 hours.
It's supposed to be a slog.
I know.
That's the nature of it.
Yeah, I enjoyed the slog for 5.5 hours. I watched every minute of the coverage from start to finish. And the finale was just incredible. I'm not sure I've seen anything quite like that, really.
Electrifying, wasn't it? I mean, I think it's an adjective we've used before, but that's the only adjective that you can really use for those last 30 kilometres of Milan-San Remo. But there were a few extra volts today. When, even compared to last year, I think it was even an upgrade on last year.
Yeah.
And our adrenaline rush sort of mirrored, kind of foreshadowed the Pogacar. You imagine the adrenaline, and we'll talk about this later, whether the adrenaline actually played a role in him being able to do what he did. And I guess we're spoiling who won already, but I suppose everyone who's listened to this will know who won. But yes, I felt the same adrenaline that he probably felt after that crash.
Yeah, I mean, it was a real make or break moment, wasn't it? The crash, 7 or 8 kilometres before the Cipressa. We'll talk in detail about what happened and what he did, of course, but the headlines are that Tadej Pogacar, all of the pre-race talk was how could he beat Matthew van der Poel. Well, he beat Matthew van der Poel before the top of the Poggio, really, but then he still had to contend with Tom Pidcock, one of the best descenders in the world, and it was still all in doubt going into the last 300 metres. A real sprint for the line, a victory for Pogacar, the world champion, in a completely scuffed and torn skin suit. Makes it 4 monuments out of 5 that he's won now. Only Paris-Roubaix is missing from his collection. Won it by 0.5 wheel. I mean, you can't really sum up or do justice to the race or Pogacar's performance or the performance of several other riders who really caught the eye in a brief summary. But it was one of the most thrilling races that I can remember watching. And as you know, Daniel, I'm hard to impress.
You're a tough crowd. Lionel, there was an omen this morning. I have to say, you mentioned Pogacar finishing with his jersey ripped and, you know, bleeding. And this morning I had a bit of a bad crash on a run, and I came back home when you were sitting watching the first few kilometers. I had blood pouring down my knee, and so I don't know, maybe I should have seen the signs there.
Well, it was a day for mishaps, really, wasn't it? Because there was a real foul up in the first kilometer or so when the break was going, and it was all the riders that you would expect to go in that break. It was a couple from Bardiani and half the Novo Nordisk team, and a few Pulte riders in their very fetching retro jerseys, certainly appealed to the nostalgia freak in me. Anyway, this break got away. I think there were 11 riders in it, and the first major roundabout they came to, they were led off course by the official race vehicles and sort of found themselves overtaking a bus and squeezing between parked cars. Nearly an embarrassing disaster for the race. I mean, there was a bit of an entente cordiale after that, whatever the Italian for entente cordiale is. The peloton sort of let a collection of riders from the same teams go away, and so no harm really done, but it was an interesting moment at the start of the race, and I suppose that set the tone and suggested that we might be in for something quite unusual.
Shall I give those chaps a name check, Lionel? Marcellusi Tarozzi of Bardiani, Milesi and Moro, both Italians. It was a very Italian break, actually, of Movistar. Peron and Lozano of Novo Nordisk, the sole non-Italian, I think. Alexis Faux-Prost of Total Energy.
Picnic Post.
Why did I think it was Total Energy? And Dario Belletta and Mirko Maestri. You mentioned that Pulte jersey, which was a nice touch, actually. Unfortunately, no Pulte rider ever did particularly well in Milan San Remo in that jersey, but it was a nice jersey. And also it really highlighted the fact that Polti really made a mess of their logo in the intervening 30 years. Anyway, Lionel.
Well, the break got away and they quite quickly got 4 minutes or so. And then we saw, like we did last year, the Sylvain Dillier show. I mean, he rode on the front for about 2/3 of last year's race, I think, didn't he? Was it last year or the year before? I think he's done this several times.
It's an annual tradition.
It's an annual tradition now, isn't it? The Swiss, ex-Swiss champion. And he rode on the front most of the day for Alpecin Premier Tech, and he was left to it. I mean, no one else really stepped up to help him for a long, long time.
Until I made it 82 kilometres to go, Lionel. And speaking of Swiss riders, we should also mention that with 242 kilometres to go, you can work out how far into the race that was, about 60 kilometres. Jan Christen crashed, Aurelius Aulard also crashed, and Movistar. They were both out of the race, and Mauro Genetti, the UAE team Emirates manager, said at the finish line that Christen has broken his collarbone.
That was a real, I thought at the time, might have been a real blow for UAE team Emirates tactics on either the Cipressa or the Poggio. I mean, Dillier did drop off the front on the Turchino and then rode his way back up to the front and took over on the front of the bunch again. A really extraordinary performance. But then there was a very strange phase of the race, wasn't there? That gap, which had been pegged at sort of 2:40, 3 minutes, perhaps up to 4 minutes at one point. With the headwind, Dillier was either sandbagging a bit or struggling to keep it.
I think tiring.
I mean, we saw some grimacing, didn't we? But still, there was a bit of a game of chicken going on. Quite interesting that nobody stepped up to take over from Dillier as the gap went up to almost 7 minutes. And that was when Domen Novak of UAE Team Emirates relieved Dillier of the responsibility for setting the pace once and for all. And then we were heading rapidly towards the Tre Capi, weren't we? And there was a surprising crash which brought down Kwiatkowski, Connor Swift and Ben Turner of Ineos Grenadiers. Filippo Ganna avoided it. I think Marcel Camprubi of Pinarello Q36.5 was the other rider involved in the initial collision. And then UAE Team Emirates were setting the pace mostly with Felix Grosschartner at this stage as the brake started to fragment over those three climbs.
We then, Lionel, we talked about iconic, well, Sylvain Dillier now being iconic, presence on the front of the race in Milan-San Remo, another iconic part of Milan-San Remo every year when they're coming to Imperia and the road narrows and the peloton, well, they come to a roundabout and they sort of fan around the roundabout. Comes back together again, always looks very dangerous on TV. Most of the time, they sort of get through without any incident. They did get through without any incident this time, but shortly thereafter, just as the peloton was approaching San Lorenzo al Mare, where they turned right to the Cipressa, how far before San Lorenzo? Was it 2 kilometres? Tadej Pogacar, the favourite, the world champion, he came down. From what we could see, it looked as though he actually caused the crash, or he might have been the first rider to go down. We then, if we squinted, we could just about see other riders in the sort of domino effect falling behind him. Wout van Aert, I think, came down. Binyam Girmay came down. And also, crucially, Mathieu van der Poel came down as well. Pogacar was pretty quick. He did pretty well to get up fairly quickly, didn't he? But at that point then, there were three main groups, certainly that the cameras were focusing on. There was the peloton at the front, which didn't really let up. You wouldn't really expect them to at that point. Then we discovered there was a Van der Poel group. Jasper Philipsen was sort of sacrificing himself for Van der Poel to get him back on. He got back on within, I would say, was about a kilometre before the foot of the Cipressa. And even further behind was Pogacar. He'd had a couple of teammates wait for him. Again, as you would expect, Florian Vermeersch was one of them. I think Grosschartner was the other. And they then sort of faced a frantic chase to try to get Pogacar back on in time for the Cipressa. And they sort of made contact with the back of the bunch, literally as the peloton was turning right onto the Cipressa, and also as the last breakaway riders were being caught.
Yeah, by that time, there were only three riders left in front, weren't they? Milesi, Belletta and Maestri. The two Polti riders were among the last three standing. That crash, actually, it looked like a coming together of Pogacar and the Danish champion, Søren Kragh Andersen, didn't it? Matteo Jorgensen was also down. Giulio Pellizzari was also down. I mean, it could have done real damage. Well, it did do real damage to the race briefly. And I was kind of anticipating at this point, are we going to have the, you know, the hysterical polemica about whether or not the front of the race should have waited? But the race is on. I mean, they're barreling into the Cipresso. If they'd have even hesitated for a moment, I'd have said cancel cycling forever. If you're not going to race when you're half a dozen kilometres from the bottom of the Cipresso, you know, they're all bets are off, aren't they? They did the right thing. They raced on. They made the chase back hard. But it was a relief that both Van der Poel's group and Pogacar's group got back in touch just in time.
You were wondering whether we would have a hysterical polemica. I was wondering who'd be the first person to mention Arnaud Démare, who of course crashed before the Cipressa and controversially reappeared somehow in the peloton and won Milan San Remo in 2015. First person that I could see anyway who mentioned it, I was certainly thinking it, but it was our good mate Hugo Kordovits.
I mean, I did have the stopwatch on when Pogacar was right on the bumper of one of the cars in the convoy, thinking, how much of this would you get away with? Really, only a couple of handfuls of seconds, really. I mean, look, I think everything was kind of above board and fair enough, really. I mean, the timing of the crash was absolutely terrible, and they deserved a fair enough chance to get back on, which they obviously did. And I mean, the most extraordinary thing on the Cipressa was that sight of Pogacar's rainbow jersey making its way the long way round everybody, because of course he's trying to move up, and the best place to move up is on the sort of outside of the peloton. So it seemed like on some of those big sweeping corners he was probably adding on sort of 10-15 metres. Because he wasn't taking this racing line through those corners. It was an extraordinary pursuit. Have to give a nod to Brandon McNulty, because he was the UAE Team Emirates rider who buried himself to drag him up, what, three quarters of least of the peloton, and then managed to do a bit more of a turn when they finally reached the front. I mean, I say finally reached the front. It only took them, two or three kilometres, didn't it?
I think even less. I think within a kilometre, they were where they had probably intended to be. And we talked in the podcast this week about McNulty was his first time riding Milan-San Remo. We didn't know exactly what role he would have. I think that was probably going to be exactly his role. They just kind of pressed play on the tape that they had imagined in the team bus in the morning, and then Del Toro came up behind, because we talked a lot about his positioning as well, and then you had the three of them. McNulty, he did a big turn, and in exactly the same point line as Pogacar launched off Narváez's wheel last year, Del Toro did a big pull and he launched again.
Yeah, and it was a very similar looking move, wasn't it? Because Matthew van der Poel was very quick to react, and in the Filippo Ganna role, Ganna didn't have the legs this year as he did last year, but instead Tom Pidcock of Pinarello Q36.5 was there. And those three then rode all the way to the top. And it, I don't know what you felt at the time, Daniel, but it did look to me like that was going to be a winning move, just because they were so decisive about it. All three of them were committed. They rode really strongly. The gap opened in the blink of an eye, didn't it? When it went to the helicopter shot and you saw just how much ground they had gained in such a short space of time, it was clear that this was the race-winning move.
And this was in spite of Little Trek being very well organised and very strong behind. We didn't know what kind of form Mads Pedersen was going to be in. He's been where I am at the moment in Mallorca. Obviously, he's not raced yet because he's been injured. And he was one of the first wheels in that main peloton. And the Little Trek boys, they got organised very quickly, didn't they? And they were doing the best they could. But as you say, the gap was going out. And I was pretty sure that it was a done deal then. I suspected that Van der Poel wasn't on his best day, just based on some of the grimaces. When Pogacar sort of attacked a second time just as they came towards the village of Cipressa, right at the top of the climb. He didn't drop Van der Poel, but Van der Poel did look as though he was struggling a little bit at that point.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not surprised. The times on the Cipressa were extraordinary, weren't they? Another 10 seconds chiselled off Pog's record last year. I think it's 8:48 for Pogacar on the Cipressa. Van der Poel only 7 seconds slower. So they were absolutely flying up there. And then the thing that really occurred to me was that we had Pogacar We had Van der Poel, who you would have thought would fancy himself if it all came down to a three-up sprint between those three. And Pidcock, a slightly different variable to last year. Last year they had a flying Filippo Ganna, who I thought might be able to do a sort of Fabian Cancellara type float off the front as they came off the Poggio. Whereas Pidcock very much had the sort of descent as his speciality, I guess. So I thought we were going to be in for a slightly more interesting and nuanced finish from that point on. And so it proved, really.
And they continue to collaborate on the, it's 9 kilometres in between the Cipressa descent and the Poggio. But the gap was coming down. We mentioned that little trek chase, and it was, I made it 10 seconds. I think at one point the graphic said it was fewer than that. It was about 7. But as Pogacar, Van der Poel and Pidcock came onto the Poggio, I made it about 10 seconds, the gap. Just enough of a cushion for them. I didn't really think they were in danger, Lionel. I don't know what you thought, because I had a sense that what Pogacar was going to do, and sure enough, on the first ramps of the Poggio, he accelerated, and very quickly he dislodged Mathieu van der Poel.
Yeah, a lot of work done there, though, in that chase by Lidl Trek's Matthias Vacek, wasn't it? He was one of the riders doing a lot of the driving on the front. And I even thought if they'd come up to the rear wheels at the bottom of the Poggio as they swung off the main road, I don't think it would have made all that much difference. No. Because Pogacar was going to do whatever he was going to do, regardless of the race situation. And I don't think we mentioned this in the preview, but the Poggio surface has been relaid, beautiful, smooth tarmac. And it was another extremely fast ascent. And I suppose the first surprise was that Mathieu van der Poel was cracking earlier, that much earlier than I thought. I thought he would hang in there, maybe struggle on that sort of steep bit, what, two thirds of the way up? There's that kind of ramp, isn't there? I thought that might be where Pogacar could crack him. But the crack happened a bit earlier, a lot earlier than I thought. Pidcock was really, I mean, he was swinging his body over the bike to stay on the wheel, did a fantastic job to stay in touch. And then I thought, is Pidcock going to have the descent to shake off Pogacar?
Mm-hmm. And interestingly, it was sort of Pogacar who was harassing Pidcock on the descent. And you know, this is a race of millimeters, and I always say it's a race that needs to be, you need to examine through a microscope, not a telescope. But you know, who knows, those few sort of accelerations that Pogacar put in on the descent, were they part of the difference? It was a very slender margin that he would win the sprint by. Who knows whether they may have been decisive.
Even when they came off the bottom of the Poggio into the streets approaching San Remo, you know, we had that shot from the corner at the top of the climb, and that gives you the real sense of how close everybody is together. The Pogacar and Pidcock, then the gap, it's not all that big, but almost unclosable to Van der Poel. And then the group was pretty much coming straight back up onto the wheel of Van der Poel. And I did wonder whether, as it got organised behind, if they were able to close the gap down a bit more, whether they'd come flying off the bottom of the Poggio and be able to catch them. I mean, it was kind of in sight, but it was just out of reach. I mean, tantalisingly yeah. out of reach for them.
The old sort of rule of thumb used to be about 10 seconds at the phone box, which is no longer there. And it was more like, I think it was 15 to Van der Poel and maybe 17 to the peloton behind. There was a counterattack out of that peloton. Van der Poel was absorbed on the descent. There was a counterattack out of that peloton. It was Wout van Aert. And he did get pretty close to Pogacar and Pidcock on Villaroma, but just at the point where he started to sort of breathe down their neck, so with about 200 metres to go. I don't know whether it affected Pogacar's choice of when to launch the sprint, but he certainly did with about 200 metres to go. And what were you thinking at that point?
Well, I was wondering, because Pidcock had ridden pretty smartly, hadn't he? He'd kind of pulled his punches a little bit when it was the three of them together. He'd kind of done short turns. He tried to manoeuvre himself in and out of position. I mean, that positioning was probably pretty crucial, and maybe that affected Van der Poel, because he was stuck on Pidcock's wheel, not getting an awful lot of shelter when they were going through doing the turns. And I just wondered, has Pidcock kind of done enough to preserve that extra little bit of zip And he did everything right, really, didn't he? He didn't sort of get suckered into going to the front, but Pogacar was just too fast, too strong, and had just enough left. But very, very close. Another 50 metres, and I suspect it might have been a dead heat.
Lionel, we'll give the results. We'll give the top 10 in a minute. But just one point quickly, in case I forget to mention it later. On the sprint on Italian TV, Silvio Martinello, the former track rider, was one of the expert pundits, and he made, well, what sounded to me like a good point about the line Pogacar took in the sprint. He sort of teased Pidcock by suggesting the barrier might be there for him. And Pidcock kind of, it seemed as though he had a look a couple of times, and then he sort of stopped his effort. And in the end, he swung way over to the left of the road, and that may have been decisive. You know, we talk, again, another thing we always say about Milan-San Remo, you can't afford to hesitate. You can never afford to hesitate at any point, really, in those last 30 kilometres. And maybe there was just a tiny moment of sort of indecision there from Pidcock.
Yeah, that's a good point, because Pogacar didn't hug the barrier, did he? He just put that little bit of doubt in Pidcock's mind. But you made the point, I think, in the preview that Pogacar laid off last year in the sprint, hoping to have the momentum to get past the obviously stronger sprinter in Mathieu van der Poel. Whereas this, I think he would have been a bit more confident if he could open it up from the front. It would be a big ask for a smaller rider like Tom Pidcock to kind of have that brute force to get level and then get past. So, it was a thrilling sprint, wasn't it? And it really, they looked at each other, and I think Pogacar knew he had it, but he wasn't 100% confident, was he, at that very split second that he crossed the line.
Lionel, let's give the top 10. So Tadej Pogacar wins Milan-San Remo for the first time. I'm going to give the time they took, since you sat through the whole thing, Lionel. 6 hours, 35 minutes, 49 seconds.
On my hourly rate, I can afford to eat tonight. Excellent.
average speed, 45.172 kilometres an hour. I don't know where that stacks up against last year. We'll check that. So those two came in 4 seconds ahead of Wout van Aert, who was caught just about on the line, but still held on for a very creditable third place, particularly considering the troubles that he's had recently. Fourth was an excellent Mads Pedersen. Fifth, Corbin Strong. Sixth, Andrea Vendrame of Jayco Alula. Seventh, former winner Jasper Stuyven. Eighth, Mathieu van der Poel. Ninth, Matteo Trentin, a rider who's gone close several times at Milan-San Remo. And 10th was Eduardo Zambanini of Bahrain Victorious. Would you like to pick out anyone else, Lionel? I can see another former winner, Matej Mohoric, was 15th. Christophe Laporte was 16th. I mean, it was a big group. It was a 37-man group.
Yeah,
that came in together.
I'd probably mention Tobias Lund Andresen of Decathlon, because they were quite visible, trying to get him into position for a potential sprint, and he's been going very well. That's probably not a bad result, I would say. Let's see there. I mean, probably first of the proper sprinters, isn't he? Yeah.
Yeah.
Corbin Strong, he's a good sprinter, but I think first of the bunch sprinters, Tobias Lund Andresen, I'd say.
I hope Mads Pedersen's not listening.
Oh, Mads Pedersen's not a bunch sprinter, is he?
Well, I would back Mads Pedersen against Tobias Lund on most sprint finishes. Anyway, I've got a bone to pick with Mads Pedersen, because you see, he was very when he talked about his injury recently and the difficulty that he was having. It was very lavatorial, the way he described it, the problems that he was having with some personal hygiene, and he went into far too much detail. Way too much information about something that he couldn't do after his injury. And after that, I vowed to become a Mads Pedersen hater for at least 2 weeks.
You mean with his two fractured wrists, he had to use the B-day?
Yeah, but he went into much more detail. It was much more graphic than that. Anyway, Lionel, that's about it for our summary. We're going to get into what it all means in part two, if you would agree, Lionel.
Spring is giving fresh start vibes. Like suddenly you want to open the windows, drink more water, and maybe act like you have your life together. But when dinner rolls around and you're this close to ordering takeout again, ButcherBox can help. They deliver premium, clean protein straight to your door. No antibiotics, no added hormones, no mystery ingredients. Just real food that actually fuels your body instead of slowing it down. Effortless glow-up energy, but make it dinner. For over a decade, ButcherBox has led the industry with meat and seafood that's antibiotic-free, hormone-free, and independently verified. Because when it comes to fueling your body, quality isn't extra. It's everything. Clean, whole protein means better support for strength, metabolism, and that steady all-day energy we're all chasing. As an exclusive offer, new listeners can get their choice between chicken breast or top sirloin for a year, or ground beef for life. Plus $20 off when you go to butcherbox.com/pods. That's right, your choice of chicken breast or top sirloin for a year, or ground beef for life. Plus $20 off your first box and free shipping always. That's butcherbox.com/pods. Don't forget to use our link so they know that we sent you.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Spring Sale and get 35% off paints and stains March 13th through the 23rd. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
Well, Lionel, the race finished, what is it, an hour and a half ago? Not quite an hour and a half ago. And, well, my adrenaline levels are still pretty high. I don't know about you, Lionel, but this is maybe influenced by the fact that I was sort of there when Cipollini won his Milan-San Remo, when Petacchi was a bit of a similar one. So two Italian riders, and I know this has been the case before as well for the Italian riders. It's a huge moment to win Milan-San Remo. But Pogacar winning today and the scenes at the finish line and what we saw on TV reminded me of this sense of deliverance, of this sense of a crusade. And it was a crusade for sort of certainly Cipollini. He spent 11, 12 years trying to win Milan-San Remo, sort of pursuing this holy grail. And that's what it's come to symbolise for Pogacar in a short period of time, because basically out of a sort of lack of other objectives left for him, that over the last sort of year or two, we've kind of zeroed in on this one as one that might ultimately elude him. So if he ever was going to do it, it was going to represent, as I say, the sort of the end of a crusade, of a campaign, a crusade, a sort of a quest, a personal quest. And that's what it felt like.
Yeah, I mean, so few riders have completed the full set of all five monuments that it's not something that we're used to seeing. And I think we've made this point, oddly, although he's only ridden Paris-Roubaix once and finished as runner-up last year, it's struck me on that day that Paris-Roubaix would probably be easier for Pogacar to win than Milan-San Remo. I just felt there were more variables for Milan-San Remo. There's more things that can go wrong. There's way more riders who might be in contention, and lots more competing interests. And it's not as attritional in the sense that Paris-Roubaix, you know, bad luck can rule out half your contenders and lack of legs can rule out the other half. And all he needs is to be good and lucky on a Paris-Roubaix day. He has the class and the speed and everything else. Whereas Milan-San Remo is it's so finely balanced that even when we saw him and Pidcock away together, there were still multiple ways he could have lost it. And if he had lost it, he would obviously come back and keep trying, but eventually I think it might be one of those things where he would think, well, if I can't win it against Pidcock, how, in what circumstances would it be possible to win? And so I think it's a real monumental victory for him. And I mean, he doesn't need to line up for Milan-San Remo again, really. I mean,
I agree with you. You mentioned Paris-Roubaix there, and for me, you may be Paris-Roubaix if, for example, he comes close this year and doesn't win, or he tries again next year and doesn't win. It may come to represent something similar, this sort of forbidden fruit. But I suppose I still feel, and I felt last year, it was such a sort of novelty. It was so unlikely, improbable, a Tour de France winner. We've not really seen it for decades. A Tour de France winner going to Paris-Roubaix and him finishing second, it almost felt as though, it didn't feel like an agonizing defeat to me. It felt more something that brought luster to his podcast, his palmarès. He doesn't have a podcast yet. Maybe that's his next objective. It brought... Yeah, I struggle to imagine, but as I say, he's sort of running out of other objectives. I almost don't imagine Paris-Roubaix seeming as elusive as San Remo has seemed. Also because I think the fact that he lives in Monte Carlo, I think people certainly people who follow the sport closely, and they're aware that he trains on this route a lot, and he's talked about it. And we, in the podcast this week, you know, we heard from the sort of special San Remo coach that he's enlisted, Nicolo Bonifacio, lives at the bottom of the Cipressa, and it all added to the sense that he really needed to slay this dragon, and he's done that now. 11 monuments. He's level with Roger de Vlaeminck now. Ooh. I'm sure Roger will be happy about that. And I'm sure there'll be some juicy quotes from Roger in the Belgian press this week. And he's a long way from Merckx. What's the Merckx number? Is it 21? But there's no one. De Vlaeminck and Pogacar are now even on second in in second place in terms of career monuments.
Yeah, Eddie Merckx's record is 19, actually. So it might be within reach for Pogacar.
Another 12 Lombardies.
But the only riders to have won all five are Eddie Merckx, Roger de Vlaeminck. That's it, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. So he is closing in on a bit of history that I don't think we imagined being equaled, really, until he came along. I think you're right, Daniel, that the results in recent years, I can remember talking about it when he finished 12th in 2020 on his first appearance, when he was still, he was just a kid then, wasn't he? And we talked then about that's quite an ominous result for a rider that we didn't really think the race suited at the time. And in a funny way, it perhaps still doesn't really suit him. So the previous results, fifth, fourth, two third places in consecutive editions, it's quite an extraordinary record. But I think it does sort of highlight the validity in that old cliche about Milan-San Remo, which is that it's very easy to finish, relatively speaking, but very hard to win. I mean, the only three riders who didn't finish today were the crash victims, only three of them, Christian, Kwiatkowski and Aulard. So Pogacar's I think it'd be a huge sense of relief that he doesn't have to wait another year and doesn't have to try again and doesn't have to kind of answer in his own mind the questions of, well, what can I do? Because we talked about what the alternatives are. It didn't work going on the Cipressa last year, dragging two riders with him. I kind of raised this sort of armchair sports director's suggestion that maybe he needed a larger group of riders to throw a few more unpredictable variables into that final climb on the Poggio, perhaps some other riders for people to be concerned about so that he could hide in the shadows to the extent that Pogacar can hide in the shadows. So when it was only three of them again, I did think, is history going to play out and repeat last year and he's going to get done? And I think that when Van der Poel was dropped, the pressure was really, really on, because then a head-to-head race with Pidcock, like I say, if he doesn't do it now, what will it take? Because then the mind games would start. Would he have to try and do something even earlier? Mm. And the terrain doesn't lend itself to that. It's all very well saying, well, go on the Tre Capi, but just not really viable. I mean, he could have made it harder on the tray cappy, put everybody under a bit more pressure, but to what ends? It's really only the Cipressa and the Poggio that can make a difference for a rider like Pogacar in terms of launching a race-winning move.
Well, they clearly didn't think much to the Pozzato suggestion, did they? There was no sign of any action on the Turchino. Interestingly, well, we talked, didn't we, in the podcast this week about how the formula, the Pogacar sort of recipe and the UAE recipe has been these very fast starts or these very fast first hours. And we said that Milan-San Remo is too long for that. You can't do that. And that was the case. We also talked about whether, you know, putting a guy in a breakaway might be an option. They didn't show any interest in that. And it probably, you know, it's probably a sort of bit of a harebrained idea anyway. But, you know, just going back, I suppose, to this idea of Milan-San Remo being so elusive as well. One of the things with Milan-San Remo, because it happens that the key phase of the race, those last 30 kilometres, they happen so quickly at such breakneck speed, that also adds to the sense that when another edition is over and he's failed again or he's not managed to win again, it makes it even more sort of tantalizing because it's gone so quickly. You can't, there's no time to think, there's no time to sort of change your strategy, and it's gone and it's another 12 months and in 12 months time it'll be like bottling lightning again. Bottling lightning is probably the best metaphor I can think of because, you know, it happens that quickly. And I think one thing that impressed me today was really remarkable, I think, was that he didn't succumb to the temptation to change his plan on when he crashed before the Cipressa. I, watching it, I was thinking, well, okay, they'll regroup now. They'll go with the plan B. He'll just ride up the Cipressa at a fairly, you know, he'll follow wheels up the Cipressa, and then he'll go all in on the Poggio. And okay, it wasn't plan A, but it might still work. And no, I mean, I said that the attack, the McNulty acceleration was in exactly the same point as the Narvaez acceleration last year and the Del Toro and so on. So it was total commitment. And again, that comes to what we said earlier about the lack of hesitation, and that committedness is what you have to have in Milan-San Remo.
Another 30 or 45 seconds on the deck sorting himself out, or a bigger problem with his bike, and that opportunity would have been gone. I mean, that's 100%. The margins of it, you know. So in a way, everything worked out absolutely perfectly because they got back in touch just in time for him to maybe have sort of a 30-second breather before they swung onto the Cipressa. And then he just, yeah, he rode the same effort that he would have rode, oh, he would have ridden from a different position in the bunch. He certainly wouldn't have wanted to be coming from that far back at the bottom of the Cipressa. But in a way, it maybe simplified things for him in the sense that he didn't have to think, he didn't have to worry about whether the moment was right or wrong. It was just commitment from that moment onwards. And perhaps also it threw a bit of doubt into the minds of his rivals, because they can't have been all that aware of where he was. Mm. They must have known he's coming. I'm sure there were some riders at 40, 50 back glancing across and seeing the rainbow jersey coming back and having a heck of a shock. Because like you say, Daniel, that moment from the crash to when Pogacar was back at the front of the race cannot have been more than about 7 or 8 kilometres. Yeah. It was an extraordinary 10 minutes.
Like you said, Lionel, I'm sure, and well, maybe he'll be asked about this in the press conference, but I'm sure if he'd been on the ground for 5 seconds longer, then he would have had to reevaluate and have gone with a plan B, because it simply wouldn't have been feasible. It was the margins were really that fine.
And the way the team adjusted as well and you know, adapted to what was a pretty devastating and chaotic situation, especially having lost Jan Christen so early in the race. You know, Domen Novak was kind of policing the early move, making sure not too many riders went across when they had this strange moment of riders who'd previously been in the original break that went off course, I think were trying to make the case that they should be allowed to go up the road as again. But I think Novak took the opportunity to say no, you know, no more than 9. And they said, sorry, you've missed the train, it's gone. And then they didn't panic when Dillier was on the front. They didn't put anybody to work too early just because the gap was going out. It was getting a little bit edgy, I thought.
Did you think it was curious that Alpecin were, and Dillier in particular, were willing to do that much work without any assistance from UAE?
Well, I suppose they were doing the same work that Dillier has done in the past. It wasn't like they put another rider up there to try and peg that gap. I suppose they were looking at the clock as well and thinking, well, if this is drifting out, how much are we prepared to let it drift out to? Maybe they were actually planning for it to drift back out again in order to, you know, create a bit of uncertainty in that final 30-40k.
Yeah, I mean, just bearing in mind as well the relationship, that we know that Mathieu van der Poel and Pogacar have a good relationship, pretty friendly. They were, most people, I would have argued that van der Poel was more of a favourite than Pogacar, but a lot of people thought they were joint favourites. So this morning in L'Equipe, they gave them both 5 stars. No one got 4 stars, no one got 3 stars. On that basis, I would have thought that for Alpecin to work, it would have been a precondition that UAE also put a guy there for several hours, as it turned out to be. It was interesting, actually. I don't know if this was mentioned on the UK commentary line, but there were some sort of suggestions that Pinarello Q36.5 were too close to the front and they were taking too much wind because they spent a lot of time in sort of second wheel right behind Dillier.
Yeah, they did, without actually doing any work themselves. But it paid off for them in the sense that Pidcock wasn't involved in the crash, was he? So their positioning was pretty good. And we know that, you know, did Pidcock need anyone else up there in the finale for him? Probably not. I think we saw a lot of the decision making on the road sort of made sense, didn't it? When van der Poel was out of position, Philipsen was the one who dragged him back across to the front group. UAE Team Emirates, maybe they played the poor us card and said, look, we've lost Jan Christen, we're having to rejig, sorry, we'd like to, but we're not going to, and Alpecin accepted that. But I mean, I don't think it would have made too much difference one way or the other. I mean, Dillier wasn't letting anybody else go in front. He didn't look especially unhappy that no one was helping him.
No. I wasn't on social media much today, but were there a lot of grumbles? Usually you see a lot of grumbles about, you know, people working with or not, you know, working for Pogacar or doing UAE's work for them. Did you see any of that?
I didn't see any of that, but I think it's, in this circumstance, that's a little bit overstated, because in so many ways, Pogacar and van der Poel had the same objective, which was to be in the right position at the key moments in the race. And so I think playing a game of chicken as they're approaching the Tre Capi and then the Cipressa would have been too much of an element of risk, I think, to sort of mess around and see, well, if you know, we're prepared to lose if you're prepared to lose, and then see if somebody else comes up to the front. I mean, who would have done it? We did see Soudal Quickstep were quite prominent as it was speeding up, trying to keep Jasper Stuyven clear of any trouble. Lotto Antomarche were near the front. Ineos did quite a good job getting on one side of the road. But really, this was just jostling for position. I don't think... I suppose the key would have been, if that gap had gone sort of beyond, well beyond 7 minutes, 8 minutes perhaps, you know, nine, if it had gone that far out, we would have had a much clearer sense that Dillier is either really tired or they're deliberately letting it go out, and this is to try and force UAE to do something. But actually, UAE, they did take it up with Novak and then Grosschartner. And then when Pogacar crashed, you know, they did a great job. Grosschartner especially did a good job riding him back across the gap. I think you said it was Vermeersch as well, wasn't it?
Yep.
And Del Toro, you know, kept calm and did what was required of him once McNulty had delivered Pogacar into the position.
I thought it was quite ironic that for 3 years people have said that Del Toro doesn't know how to position himself in front before the Cipressa, and then the one time where it looked as though Pogacar was out of the race, he was miles out the back, that there was Del Toro in third wheel on the Cipressa.
Yeah, and I was a little surprised that his effort wasn't a bit longer, but it was enough, wasn't it? It was enough to give Pogacar what he needed at that point. And yeah, then once they were away, that was, it was absolutely breathtaking to watch. And like I say, an even more perfect combination of three riders than it was last year, simply because I wondered what Pidcock would do on the descent. And the fact that he didn't lead all the way down, and Pogacar went back to the front. I thought that was quite telling. Maybe Pogacar was worried that Van der Poel would close back up, or that the gap wasn't quite enough.
I mean, I still think that the likes of, you know, lay people like you and I probably take too much of the descending for granted. And again, to mention Bonifazio, of course, he became famous for that incredible descent that he did of the Cipressa in 2019, and he's been advising Pogacar on the lines to take. And by all accounts, or, you know, he's, as well as the interview he did with us, he's been in L'Equipe and so on and so forth, and they've done a lot of work on those two descents, Poggio and Cipressa, and maybe that was what sort of evened out Pidcock's natural advantage, what would ordinarily have been his advantage on those two descents.
I mean, I've descended both climbs on open roads with traffic coming the other way, and it is hairy. It is hairy. And I think you're right. We do take it for granted because they're so skilled. And I think that drone shot, which was even better this year than last year that the broadcasters had, gave the sense of how on the edge and just about in control they are. There were a couple of little moments where a combination of the drone wobbling and the riders wobbling had me right on the edge of the seat thinking that somebody was going to, you know, misjudge a corner. It is miraculous the speed they go down there. It's not just practice, is it? It's instinct. It's seeing in 4D, really. And I suppose the drone shot stops you from tuning out a little bit on the descent, which I think sometimes you can, when, especially with the helicopter shot from a distance, you sort of see them swooping down. You know, it looks so graceful and smooth. You lose a sense of danger that they're embracing in order to get down there. And it was really breathtaking to watch. And then that little run to the finish, it always strikes me, it surprises me, catches me out how far it is. You know, because you, in your mind's eye, before the race starts, you think, oh, they come off the Poggio, they go around one corner and that's the finish. And it's not like that at all. And I remember when Simon Gill and I rode it, you know, it is quite a long way. And there's plenty of time for things to happen. Oh, and
it seemed longer to you than it did to Pogacar.
Well, I mean, it's exactly the same distance for him
Gill
and for me.
Versus Pidcock Pogacar.
Look, I'm not trying I'm not trying to compare myself to Pogacar here. I'm just saying that there is, it's after all of that kind of edge of the seat stuff on the climb and on the descent, it's almost like somebody's taken the plug out of the wall, or the clock has been stopped, and it goes into a sense of, oh, there, something might happen here. And I was just waiting for that long shot, just to see a flash of yellow in the distance of Wout van Aert coming across, but the gap was just that little bit too big. But it's a great finish, that. It is a really good finish. And we've seen it plenty of times in the past where there's been a real surprise, and, you know, and the camera foreshortens the gaps between the riders as well. And it's so wide. It gives the impression that they've got a lot of space to play with. And so it kind of, it heightens the tension in its own way, that final stretch in the Via Roma. Great stuff.
Well, Lionel, it's going to be a difficult one to top that, certainly. Well, as we said, if Pogacar does do the mic drop and he's not back next year, we'll get a very different race, I think. But his next outing will be in Tour of Flanders in 2 weeks, unless I suspect that the injuries he sustained today are, they won't be serious enough to keep him out of the Tour of Flanders in 2 weeks. Interestingly, as many of the listeners will already be aware, Tom Pidcock is not doing the Cobble Classics this year. His next race is Catalunya, which starts in 2 days on Monday, and he's then doing the Ardennes Classics. Van der Poel, of course, we will see in the Classics, in the Cobble Classics, that is. Anything else you'd like to mention, Lionel?
Well, I think we do need to mention Mads Pedersen again. You know, that crash was on the opening day of the Volta Valenciana 6 weeks ago. I mean, he's got half a day's racing under his belt. He's fractured both wrists. He's unable to wipe his bottom, Daniel.
I'm not bringing up the quote. You can bring it up when we finish recording. You look at the, you bring up the quote.
No, I'm not going to do that. And I think he said before the race, the decision was made on Wednesday night. He felt that he could start and ride. Probably a decision made more straightforward by the fact that Little Trek sprinter, Jonathan Milan, had to pull out of the race through illness. But I have to say, at the moment, Milan-San Remo is not a sprinter's race, so I don't see that Jonathan Milan would have been much of a feature in the finale. But to ride the race, to be so well positioned at the bottom of the Cipressa, to ride so strongly on the two climbs and then finish fourth, a heck of a ride by Mads Pedersen, really bodes well for what he can do in, I would argue, Paris-Roubaix is a big target for him. You know, his wrists will be feeling stronger by then, and he'll have another 3 weeks of racing in the legs. And also Visma Lisa bike, you know, they had Matt Brennan was supposed to be riding, and then he got ill as well and pulled out on the eve of the race, which I guess would have rejigged their priorities a bit. And I thought, Wout van Aert, that's the best we've seen him for quite a long while in a really big race, isn't it?
Yeah, I think the underlying, a lot of people's feeling about Wout van Aert is that his issue, if he does have any issues, are confidence related rather than physical issues. To do with positioning and so on and so forth. And well, today he certainly looked very strong, didn't he? It'll be interesting. Obviously, it's a very, very different environment when he goes to Belgium and the cobbled races. But we certainly in decent form, decent condition. Lionel, a couple of other riders, well, one rider in particular who is going to be watched with some interest in the Cobble Classics, and Paul Magnier. A lot of people fancied him to have a good showing today because obviously he's won a lot of races the last few months, and you've got people comparing him to Tom Bonan, obviously rides for the team that Bonan used to ride for. He didn't fare too well today. He was 80th. Finished in 80th in a group that came in 3 minutes, 45 seconds down.
Yeah, I mean, when I say about Van Aert, I think it's his first monument podium for a little while, because he did actually have quite a consistent spring last year, but he was kind of the nearly man of the races, because he was fourth in Flanders, fourth in Roubaix, fourth in the Amstel Gold Race, and second in two of the kind of second tier races, Dwars door Vlaanderen and Brabantse Peel. So, but I felt we saw a more aggressive Van Aert, really, maybe a little bit more carefree, a bit less pressure, perhaps. He was trying something rather than, you know, riding in a bit of a sort of best of the rest capacity.
Yeah, and I mean, it was a good day in that respect for Visma Leasebike. Obviously, they had some problems with Jorgensen. Of this sort of other kind of aspiring super teams, Ineos, obviously their plan A was Ganna, and he only finished 33rd in the end, so not a great day for him. Another aspiring super team who struggled, I would suggest struggled, I mean, we saw them at the front before the Cipressa, but Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe, of course, they had that disastrous Classics campaign last year, and their best rider today was Lawrence Pithy, who's gone well in this race before, but he was 19th, Lawrence Pithy. He'll be hoping for better, I imagine, in the next few weeks.
A huge corrections corner, live correction corner. Rick Van Looy has also won all five monuments, of course.
So. I always get confused because there's always the Paris-Tour question. And this was something that was often levelled at Merckx, that, oh, he didn't have a complete palmarès because he didn't win Paris-Tour. And I always forget whether Rick Van Looy won all the monuments plus Paris-Tour, which was the case, I believe. As it was with Roger de Vlaeminck, I think, as well.
Merckx didn't win Strade Bianche either.
No, he didn't.
50 years too old for that.
Yeah. Who knows? Maybe. I hear he's recovered from his latest operations, and yeah, who knows? Merckx Remontada in 2027. Right. We'll return in the middle of the week with a bit more sort of San Remo debriefing.
Correct everything we've got wrong today.
Putting it into context. And we might be accompanied by Larry Warbus this week, who wasn't in the field in Milan-San Remo. He didn't ride in Milan-San Remo. I think he might be at altitude on this week. But anyway, he might be with us this week. But we will certainly be back to discuss Catalunya, San Remo, and any and every other business.
Yeah, we'll be looking ahead to the next Belgian Cobbled Classics E3.
Corbett's Corner. We'll have some Corbett's Bank. Corner. Yeah. We'll definitely have some Corbett's Corner.
Yeah. Gent-Wevelgem at the weekend, which has changed the name, and it's going to take me about 5 years to get used to calling it something different. In the meantime, do tune in to Rose Manley and Rebecca Charlton recapping the women's race at Milan-San Remo, which is online now.
Have a good evening, Lionel.
You too, Daniel. I'll see you in the week.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.
So you're running out of closet space. The good news? You don't need to stop shopping. You just need to start selling with The RealReal. The RealReal is the world's largest and most trusted resource for authenticated luxury resale. Whether it's that mini bag that can't even fit your phone or those boots you never fully broke in, The RealReal handles everything from photography and copywriting to shipping and pricing. So you can just sit back, get paid, and make room for things that actually feel like you. And with 10,000 plus new arrivals every single day from top designers like Prada, Celine, Louis Vuitton, and Loewe, all for up to 90% off retail, you're bound to find something perfectly on brand to fill that extra closet space with. Plus, right now, you can get an extra $100 to shop when you sell for the first time. Make room for what feels like you. Go to TheRealReal.com to start selling and get your extra $100 to keep shopping at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com. Terms apply.
Use math to make the world a better place. Become an actuary through the Society of Actuaries and find solutions to the world's most pressing challenges. As an actuary, the only thing higher than the pay is the satisfaction.
Thank you for calling the Bombas Comfort Line. Bombas make socks, slippers, tees, and underwear made with the highest quality materials. Press 1 for comfort, 2 for style, 3 for donation.
You chose style. Bombas has styles for whatever you enjoy. You can run in Bombas, lounge in Bombas, dress them up, dress them down, but always give back in Bombas. Because with every item purchased, another is donated. Bombas, comfort worth calling for. Go to bombas.com/audio and use code audio for 20% off your first purchase. That's BOMBAS.com and use code audio.